Welcome to Criterion Close-Up, Episode 2, where we're going to talk about My Life as a Dog by Lassie Hallström. I have some good news and some bad news to begin this cast. My bad news is that Mark Herney, my co-host, is not available. He had vacation. We intended to work around his schedule, but it just did not work. So he's not going to be here. We do have him in spirit, and in we have some clips we're going to play of him. He did watch the film and take some notes. The good news is I have a co-host, or a mystery co-host, who is joining me for the first time, and I'll introduce him as somebody that I've podcasted with before. What's interesting is a few weeks ago, I guess about a month ago, I did a podcast for FlixWise on Watership Down, and we had another friend of mine was going to be the third and participate. Something happened, and he had to cancel at the last minute, so good friend Martin Kessler stepped in with 2 hours' notice. Is that right, Martin?
Something like, I think I had just enough time to watch the film.
So he watched the film, and I think actually we had to bump it an hour just so you had time to watch the film, which is pretty important. And then as coincidence turns out, with Mark's vacation, we for episode two, we needed somebody to fill in. So my first thought was, wait, Martin's a pinch hitter. So, Martin, can you be on our podcast and watch Life as a Dog? And Martin Kessler, thank you for showing up and for joining us.
Thank you so much for letting me be on. I'm really excited.
Martin is a co-producer of FlixWise, so I've heard him there, and of course I've been on with him there. But Martin, do you want to talk about yourself and about FlixWise, what you do over there?
Sure, I've only been on a few episodes, actually, but I've helped edit a couple of them, and it's a really fantastic place to talk about films. The FlixWise host and producer, Lady P, she's going through all the sight and sound films, so it's really fantastic. You get to talk about a lot of really great, interesting classic films, contemporary films, and there's also bonus episodes where people can pitch films that they think should be on the sight and sound list but aren't. So there's been some really interesting pitches. The one I did so far, I pitched Starship Troopers as one of the greatest films ever made. So that was mine.
I really enjoyed that episode. That was great. Yeah,
thank you.
And I'm a fan too, so I was in agreement. But and actually, that's called the FlixWise Favorites, and that was the same type of episode that Watership Down, which is not on the sight and sound list. So so I pitched that as a, because I think animation is lacking on that list, and I think we had fun. And another coincidence, I think that episode is going to come out this week. Is that right?
I believe so. It should be out very soon. I was a little bit harsh on that episode. I had some regrets after because I felt like, oh, maybe I was a little bit too hard on Watership Down.
Well, you told me you saw the Blu-ray since then, right? And I know you because of the scramble, you had to catch a VHS, right?
Well, I watched the iTunes version, which is much, much nicer than watching it on VHS. And I was actually really just impressed with all the painted detail that was in it, because like in my mind watching it on VHS it was just all like flat cell animation the whole way through, and I didn't realize maybe just how much work exactly had gone into animating it.
Well, when you guys hear us on FlixWise, keep that in mind. I think this episode will probably come out before the FlixWise one though, and so we won't spoil what happens there, but I think we had a good discussion. One thing, I don't know if it came out, but I was actually ill for that episode, physically ill. So I had to make some arrangements and had to do some shifting. And you edited it, so I guess you know better than anybody if that came out. But I still think we had a good discussion.
I think so. I think people are going to really appreciate it. I'm sure I'm going to upset a lot of fans.
Hey, don't spoil it now. So, okay, let me start out. This is episode two, of course. We just launched this boat last week, and I wanted to do a little bit of housekeeping. We got a lot of great comments, in fact, most positive, some, I wouldn't say negative, but there were some constructive criticisms. One thing that came out a lot was the music. People heard the broadcast news music as the intro, and they were like, what is this? This is some cheesy 80s theme song. Why are you, well, we probably should have mentioned last time that we are actually using the theme of the movie for the music for each episode. So that was, of course, the broadcast news, and the music you heard to begin this episode was My Life as a Dog. My Life as a Dog is not as upbeat, so kind of a somber score, so we didn't let that go on too long. Another thing I wanted to talk about is our spoiler policy. I know a lot of people are spoiler sensitive. I'm somewhat spoiler sensitive, but kind of not too, but generally I don't listen to podcasts or read blog posts unless I've seen the film or I don't know about you, if you feel the same way, Martin.
I have to be careful because I'm very spoiler insensitive. Sometimes I don't care at all if somebody spoils a film for me. It's sort of,
In fact, on the Flixwise, you almost spoiled a film for me, and which I still haven't gotten a chance to check out.
But I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. You didn't. So here we are going to be careful not to spoil a film, and I think we were successful with broadcast news. In fact, some people thanked us for not giving away too much. Some films we won't have a choice because, you know, some films the ending is a huge part of the film. Of course, I won't go into those now because that would be spoiling them. But just keep the good thing is we will give warning if we're going to spoil a film or if anything might be spoilerish. This film will have a couple plot points that we will have to spoil, but they come around, you know, towards the first third or half of the film. More housekeeping. We didn't have a Twitter last time. Now we do, which is a funny story. We tried to get Criterion Close-Up as our Twitter, but Criterion Close-Up was one too many characters. So we, at first, were Criterion Close-A. And, of course, we had some infantile jokes about where's the P, you know, and we went off from there. But it just looked wrong. So we changed that to Criterion CU. So the CU stands for close up, and I guess you could also joke that says it stands for see ya. That is the Twitter address, is Criterion CU, and I'll put that in the show notes. I mentioned that we're going to cover a lot of titles. One thing I should have mentioned is we plan to cover one new release a month from Criterion, and we actually are going to make an exception to that rule for October because it's a big month, and we're going to cover two. And I can tell you that next month is going to be Moonrise Kingdom. The month after that will be The Brood and Mulholland Drive. And hopefully the month after that will be Pooh. We'll see probably tomorrow. We also have Hiroshima Mon Amour coming up, 12 Angry Men, House. We have The Music City to celebrate Pooh, assuming it gets announced. And then next week, what we're calling our episode Geek Fest. And what we're going to do is we're going to go through a lot of rumors and confirmed Criterion announcements. We're just going to go through these huge lists we've compiled, and I think it'll be a lot of fun. We're going to really, really geek out on what's hopefully coming and what might be coming from Criterion. And then the last bit of housekeeping is I just wanted to give you a heads up that we're going to have a big announcement that we can't say anything about just yet. I would expect that middle of the week towards next week, so I would keep an eye on CriterionBlues.com or our Twitter, Facebook. I, again, can't say anything, but it's going to be exciting. So are you excited, Martin?
Yeah, I'm very curious.
Well, you might actually, this might be something you'll be involved with, so we'll see.
Oh, okay.
All right, well, now that all that boring housekeeping stuff is out of the way, we're going to go into some news, Criterion news, and Martin, feel free to chime in. We kind of had a short news segment last time, even though we plan to do this more extensively going forward, so I probably have a few more items than we usually will, because a lot of these have been from the last couple weeks. The big one is announcements are probably going to be tomorrow, Monday. This cast might go up tomorrow, so in that case, today. And so there are a lot of people are expecting a Pooh trilogy to be announced. There's a lot of speculation that another Eclipse series will be announced. There's talk about, of course, The Graduate and Cold Blood. So anyway, one thing I should warn people is not to get their hopes up. The last couple Mondays, I heard they postponed them or there were trouble with the announcements. So we're going to cross our fingers on that we get them on time. And if not, well, we'll just have to wait another day. So Martin, do you have any predictions or wish lists for things to be announced? Or,
I mean, the Pooh trilogy seems like pretty much a lock at this point. Which, I mean, you never know with Criterion. The fact that we're all expecting it to come might mean we won't see it for a while. But that would be very exciting to see the Apu trilogy.
Yeah, I think people should temper their expectations. I mean, I don't know, by the time a lot of people listen to this, the announcements will be out. But one thing I've noticed is that the Janus screening of the film has been very popular. And so a lot of times they wait until the theatrical run is for sure over before they announce. So even though I think most people expect it in November, because there was a leak a few months ago or a magazine article or something, I could see it be in December or January. So don't be upset. I think it's for sure coming, yeah. Though.
Pretty much for sure. Almost definitely, maybe.
I would say almost positively. I think yeah. it's for sure. But any other predictions or wishes?
The New Worlds one I've been hoping for all year, and it's been teased at, and I think it seems pretty likely that it might come out this month.
Which one was
the announcement? The New World, the Terrence Malick film.
Oh, The New World. Yeah, that was teased in the newsletter, which the New Year's drawing. I mean, which was so that's a good. 3 seasons ago.
I'm hoping for like a really robust package for that one too, since there's different versions of the film, and I've heard that Terrence Malick just cut a new version of the film fairly recently. Mm-hmm. And I would love it if they threw in a really great surprise special feature, like his early short film Lanton Mills, which is a comedy with Harry Dean Stanton and Terrence Malick himself acting in it.
Cool.
Yeah. So I mean, probably not. That seems unlikely, but you can hope.
Yeah, they do. They do tend to put on multiple versions. My memory is the Gold Rush had a lot of versions, and of course, Mr. Arkandin was a box set with I think three versions of that film. So, yeah, I think there's got to be at least two or three. In fact, who knows? Maybe if they cut one, they might cut the theatrical.
I mean, it's possible that Malick might insist on maybe a new version being the definitive version, and discouraging people from watching old ones. I don't know, but I would love to see and compare all the different edits. I think another one there's probably a good chance of being announced is Clouds of Sils Maria, which is one of the best films I think I've seen so far this year, and it's really, really interesting. It's I think there was some kind of a leak a little while ago. Somebody on Twitter mentioned that Criterion's working on it, so that seems like a possibility.
Yeah, it's an IFC film, and there was a leak earlier in the year, or I can't remember exactly where, and it's Criterion usually gets their, well, it supposedly gets their first choice for IFC films, and of course they have The Dardens is coming out, I think next week. 2 days, one night. But then somebody else got the rights to the DVD, but nothing has been said about Blu-ray, so I could see it being Blu-ray. I think Paramount is doing a DVD. I could be wrong on the studio. I forget who released it. But, it's completely possible that Criterion will release that. And I also enjoyed that movie very much. I think it was a very meta, breaking the third wall, superhero even satire,
It's a really fantastic kind of follow-up to Irma Vep, which is in a lot of ways very similar, and it's like very actors acting kind of a movie, which I love. Like I think it might make a really good double feature with something like Vanier and 42nd Street. I think it'd be for people who enjoy performance and just seeing how actors work and kind of what goes on behind that, it's very interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, no, the Criterion Collection likes who they like too, and they definitely like Asaeus, and actually, I enjoy Irmavep as well. And in fact, that's not outside of the realm of possibilities. Anyway, I do have a lot of news items, so I'll move on.
Okay.
Another thing is, I didn't even mention my own wish list. mine is La Chien. Every month, mine is La Chien from Jean Renoir or any Renoir from the 30s. So,
right.
Okay, there we go. another news item is that the Third Man, there was a Studio Canal release in England and in France that is getting incredible marks. It's from the 4K restoration, and of course that, you know, pretty much seals the deal. Criterion's not going to get that back. But one thing I've noticed is, and I thought people might want to be on the lookout because the Third Man tends to be the most expensive of those out-of-print ones, is I've seen that there have been a lot of copies on sale. And in fact, I'm bidding on one, and probably by the time this comes out, I'll know whether I got it or not. Right now, it's at a pretty good price, so I'm crossing my fingers. I did see another one go for $50 on eBay, and I've seen a number of them on eBay, and I've had two people offer to sell me theirs because they're going to upgrade. So just FYI, if you want the Criterion, if you're a completist, it could be for now might be the time. The next thing, and I'd like to hear what your thoughts are on this one, Martin.
Okay.
Wim Wenders is having a Janus Films is touring a retrospective of a lot of his films. In fact, they're doing a major tour of them, and I have a list here of the ones that are confirmed. The Goalie's Anxiety at the Penalty Kick, Alice in the Cities, King of the Road, The American Fiend, Tokyo Ga, Until the End of the World, Paris, Texas, and Wings of Desire. And of those, only two, the last two, are already released. So,
I think, is Tokyo Ga paired as a special feature on, I think, one of the Ozu films?
You know, I think you're right. I think it is. It might have been Tokyo Story. I'd have to look that up. I'll look that up and put it in the show notes. But
I think I have it somewhere.
Okay, I know there is a good documentary on the Tokyo Story disc. So that could be it. Have you seen the Road Trilogy or any the American Fiend? Any of these?
I haven't seen the Road Trilogy. I've seen Paris, Texas, and I've seen Wings of Desire. But out of the ones you mentioned, that's about it.
Okay, well, I've seen the Road Trilogy, and I actually think it's going to be fantastic. In fact, Kings of the Road is probably my favorite Wenders. I can say it's close with Paris, Texas, and Wings of Desire. It's a long road, well, obviously a road movie, and it has the same actor as Alice in the City's Rudiger Vulgar, I think is his name. I could be completely wrong on that. What was interesting though were not included in this retrospective, and one of them was Wrong Move, which is the middle trilogy, and that one has a young Kinski. It's good. I'd say it's the weakest of the three. Some very good tracking shots. Buena Vista Social Club. I would expect to see that one someday. And The State of Things were not mentioned. So have you seen any of those?
No, I would love to see Criterion release Far Away So Close, though, sometime, which is the sequel to Wings of Desire and also has Kinski in it. She plays Angel, and it's maybe not quite as good as Wings of Desire, but it's a really excellent film, too, I think.
That would be fun. Yeah, I'm actually really interested in Until the End of the World. I haven't seen it, but I know there's a really long cut. I think maybe a 3 or 4 hour cut. No. On that note, I'm going to move on to the next one because talking about long films, it segues very nicely. So another news item that is not specifically Criterion related, but I'm going to tie it in, is Arrow Films has announced their, I guess it's November releases, and they're releasing a big Jacques Rivette box set.
Oh, yeah.
Out One, yeah, very long film, so... In fact, I've already pre-ordered it. It has Out One, Duel, Noiro, I guess it's pronounced. And it's a really beautiful-looking release. I think there's a 150- or 200-page booklet. It doesn't have Celine and Julie Go Boating, which is the most requested, but that one's with New Yorker Films, and I don't think that's gonna be coming out anywhere. I don't think. Now, there's been a lot of controversy because Jacques Rivette. Are you a Rivette fan, Martin?
From what I've seen, yeah, I'm a huge fan.
Okay, yeah, that's the problem. Nobody's seen enough.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he's just not. And you know, you'd think Criterion would be the ideal outlet for him. The rumor is that somebody, some executive, and I don't know if it's Peter Becker or who, is not a fan of Rivette, and that's what has been kept him away. I actually have not seen any. I own the Le Pont du Nord, Masters of Cinema, which I will watch someday, and I blind bought out one. So it's from what I understand, Rivette is a love-hate director. Oh, I'm sorry. I have seen Celine and Julie Go Boating, but I saw it after surgery on some serious pain meds, and it did not work.
Oh no, I would think that might be the best time to watch Celine and Julie Go Boating.
That was my thought process, but it actually worked because I think you really have to think to get that one. I could tell it was amazing, but I knew it was not the right time, and I shelved it. So, have you seen that one?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Are you a fan?
Yeah, I really like Celine and Julie Go Boating. That's also a pretty long film, too. I think that might be, I don't know, like close to 3 hours.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
He makes some pretty long movies.
He is probably not good friends with his editor. and actually, Celine and Julie, I think, is on the Sight and Sound list pretty high. So that might be one that FlixWise will or won't cover someday in the future. Mm-hmm. Another one is there's a Eureka release of the Shohei Imamura Masterpiece Collection, and I'm not going to list those, but there are 9 of his films, one of which is a Blue Criterion, which is Vengeance Is Mine, and there are a lot of other ones. There's The Ballad of Narayama. Wait, I think that's Criterion.
I think is his the remake.
That's right. The old one is Criterion. Yes.
Yes.
And then there's Pigs and Battleships and Stolen Desire. Stolen Kisses, is it? I didn't write the list up. But a lot of times I've noticed with Eureka and Masters of Cinema that they predict what's going to come out on Criterion. So it's possible that this means that we'll see some Imamura. I think the big question is how well would he sell? Do you think he'd sell it very well? Are you a fan?
Well, he'd sell to me.
Me too.
I have Vengeance Is Mine and the Pigs and Battleships, the set.
Yeah, me too. I haven't watched the Masters of Cinema and Pigs and Battleships. I think it's out of print now because of this release.
Right.
And another tidbit I jotted down on that same note, because the UK releases are very kind of intermingled with the Criterions. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of Masters of Cinema titles come out on Criterion and vice versa. I noticed that Arrow's releasing The Honeymoon Killers, but they're releasing the Criterion restoration. So I just thought that was interesting that Criterion gave Arrow a release for UK. So it's definitely not coming out in the US because it's coming out on Criterion. And that's one more. Another foreign release, The Fallen Idol, is coming out from Studio Canal on October 19th. So, sorry, guys. The Criterion's probably not coming back. So that is it for my news. Do you have any thoughts on any of what we just talked about?
Well, I think it's a really exciting time for home video, actually, as much as they talk about market dropping out. Like, I can't believe that there's going to be a set of all of... Jacques Rivette's films that'll be available to people. I'm thrilled. My wallet's going to be empty for the next while.
Yeah, the whole fall is really stacked. And you know, if we get Apu I think it's almost we almost have to predict a box set from Criterion because it's been actually really, unless you count the Sean Gregory, there hasn't been one all year. But yeah, I also ordered the Yoshida. A box set. As a guilty pleasure, I ordered Hellraiser, so it's already a very expensive fall for me. And of course, and that's how I got the Rivette, was through the Arrow points.
Right.
All right, well, now that we've covered the news, let's go ahead and get into My Life as a Dog.
Okay.
Back in a minute. Welcome back. What you just heard was dog barking. And that's appropriate. That's from My Life as a Dog, and that was the main character, the child, Ingmar. He would express himself by barking like a dog. So if you've seen the movie, you probably understand why. Well, hopefully. I'm not sure I understand the reason why. But we're talking about My Life as a Dog, and I'll set up the film here. It's a Swedish film from Lasse Hallström. The Swedish title is Mitt liv nam hund. Excuse my Swedish if there are any Swedish listeners, which I think looks like a pretty literal translation. It was 1985. It was pretty much the breakout film for Hallström. He never worked in Sweden again. He came to the United States, and we'll talk about him more. It was nominated in 1988 for Best Director and Best Writing Oscars, and I'd say that's pretty impressive for a foreign film. Actually, Babette's Feast won the foreign film that year, and I'm guessing that just because it came out in Sweden in 85, I'm guessing it wasn't eligible, otherwise it probably would have won. It did win other awards, won a Golden Globe and Independent Spirit for Best Foreign Film. Again, released in Sweden, came out in the U.S. actually in 87, and then the awards were 88. I did find there was a sequel planned for a few years afterward, which would have had the same actor that played Ingmar, and it would have been directed by Graham Clifford, who has done a few. He did Francis and a few other things. That sequel, as we know, didn't come to fruition, and the actor that plays Ingmar stopped acting. So, My Life as a Dog. Martin, how would you summarize My Life as a Dog?
I mean, there's not much plot going on. It's sort of a story in two acts, I guess. It's he gets sent away from home twice to live with his aunt and uncle in a small village. And a lot of it's the sort of gentle observational humor about people's quirks and sort of disasters coming from good intentions, and it's a very sort of gentle film. I think it's sweet and funny, but also melancholy. It's more out of an emotional piece, I think, than something that you can really summarize with the plot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it's it is, but a dramedy maybe, but more of a poignant coming of age dramedy. Mm-hmm. And as far as the plot, you're right. It's very basic, which is probably a good thing for our discussion. Just about a mischievous child who is, I guess you could say, he's sexually curious, and dealing with the illness with his mother, and being sent away to, it was actually Småland, and I'm probably pronouncing that incorrectly, which actually translates as small land. So it is a small town. And actually, yeah, you're right. That town is a lot of fun, despite the difficulties that he's having in life. It has a lot of quirky characters, a lot of fun characters, and I think we see how he learns about himself through these characters. So yeah, the characters were there. There was the roofer, which was a cute character, but very, very different. There was the boy with green hair, and I could never figure out why he had green hair. Did you pick up on that?
No, I don't think it's ever explained. He's just the boy with green hair, and I think that's how he's credited too.
Is it? I didn't know. I do like that they don't go out of their way explaining things, and even plot points. They don't go out of their way, and that's a good thing. There's, of course, the uncle and aunt Gunnar and Ulla, and I really liked Gunnar. I don't know how you felt about him.
Yeah, I really liked his character, actually. That might be my favorite. I mean, my other favorite character is probably the tomboy Saja. Yeah, I really like the people in the town. It's there was also the woman who worked at the glass factory, who was doing the new modeling and the
Barrett
artists.
yes Barrett, we will talk about Barrett, don't worry about that. Barrett had a very, very big part to play. Yeah, and I liked that Gunnar, and again, we see things really from Ingmar's perspective, but Gunnar is obviously aware of the difficulties that, or the tragedies that are going on in his life, and I think he goes out of his way to try to make Ingmar home, welcome. Even in the first scene, he kind of plays with the kid and is mischievous. And then they build that little summer home, which is really a gazebo of some type, and they play that song over and over again, which just angers.
Oh, "För jag kan inte få upp min kokosnöt."
Exactly. Yes, it's on my iTunes right now. And actually, I could not find it anywhere. Otherwise, I would have played it, much to Ula's chagrin. So yeah, I thought that the scenes with Ingmar and Gunnar were a lot of fun, very light, but not schmaltzy light, you know.
Right, yeah.
Pleasant.
No, I agree.
There was also the Arvidssons, excuse me, and there was they lived with Gunnar and Ulla, and Mr. Arvidsson had Ingmar read from a lingerie book.
"Read to me, Ingmar."
Yeah, that's like me.
Poor
saying,
man in his deathbed, just asking to be read to, and then, of course, when he gets him to read, it's really funny.
It was funny, yes. But that's like me asking to read the Victoria's Secret lingerie. Read the descriptions. And again, that's where I think it gets the sexuality and the gets intertwined. It seems innocent, but I think for Mr. Arvidsson, it was sort of a an indulgence.
Yes.
Yeah, you mentioned. Actually, I had her name as Saga. It might have been Sasha. Yes.
It's hard to say the Swedish pronunciation. I think it's sort of like Sasha, but with like a harder sound in the middle.
Yeah, I think it's a translation. I did see on IMDb she's credited as Saga. So like a saga, like, you know, epic. But she's definitely not epic. She was an interesting character, tomboy. But yeah. What did you think of Saga or Sasha?
I thought she was a really well-rounded character, actually. I almost was maybe more interested in her character at times than I was in Ingmar for a few minutes. Like, she sort of wants to be like the boys and play with them in soccer and boxing, but I think she's also starting to become a little bit more aware of the world sexually and maturing, and there's kind of that tension with her where she doesn't quite know how to resolve it, and it it comes out in a really sort of interesting and a little bit funny way, I think, with especially I think in the second half when she decides to fight Ingmar.
Yeah. She was a tough one. I would not want to fight her. But I thought it was interesting how she tried to pass as a boy and was worried about girlhood. Specifically, I think the quote was, "How long does it take for breasts to grow?" You know, because that was a concern. But I liked the way she interacted with Ingmar. It was a boys will be boys relationship. You know, they fought, they played. And then the one scene where he strapped down her breasts, you know, maybe a little controversial, and in fact, definitely controversial. We'll get to that in a moment. But you kind of wonder, is for them, it seemed like they were playing as peers, boy, boy. But in reality, of course, there was boy, girl. There was one scene that I thought was pretty moving where they're boxing, and then all of a sudden she hugs him.
Yeah, it's a really tender moment.
Yes. Of course, there's a important sexual overtones that we'll be talking about. And speaking of which, Barrett, the buxom blonde that everybody in the town is interested in. And one thing about Ingmar, he was kind of a ladies' boy. He had a girlfriend in his home. Remember, they would sit under the train tracks.
Yes.
And then he, of course, Saga took to him. And and then Barrett, not as romantic, but she, there's the one scene. You know which one I'm talking about?
Yep.
For those who don't, it's a scene where Barrett is posing for a sculpture, and she's posing in the nude. And what's really odd is she brings Ingemar along, and he sits in the other room. And then he decides, actually, there's two sessions. And in the second session, he decides to climb onto the roof and look at her directly above her from the roof. And I would want to do this exact same thing. Excuse me. I don't know about you, Martin, but I don't know. Would you have done the same thing in a similar circumstance as 12, at a 12-year-old?
I don't think I would. No.
You don't think you would?
No, I'd be the kid who'd be too worried that he would fall through the ceiling and get caught.
Yeah, that I think I would be too worried that I'd be too nervous of showing that I was interested. But I would sure want to, and that's why I think it's the first scene when he's just sitting in the other room. I'm sure that's all he was. In fact, the film language pretty much sets that up, that he's just curious what's going on there, knowing that this very buxom lady is in full display in the other room. So,
well, sort of the arc of his sexual understanding, it kind of goes from sweet and innocent to sweet and not so innocent. I think, like, at the very beginning, his girlfriend, when they say that they're married, and
yes, that's right.
It sort of feels like he's not really aware of the implications of what they're doing, playing on top of each other. You know, to him, it's just playing. And mm-hmm. I think gradually, by the end, you see is a more adult understanding of his attraction to women.
Yeah, I'd say it's as far as coming of age. And in fact, even though it's the plot is completely different, it reminded me of Closely Watched Trains, which was, of course, an old, much older character, but it's a sexual coming of age. And I think that for Ingemar, it was the same. You know, he was learning about girls, and, we're both men. We can both relate. We were both 12. I think that was 12. He was 12.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think the sexuality is pretty important. And early on, his brother tries to teach them. It's almost like a birds and the bees kind of in the schoolyard lesson, yeah, with the bottle. But it becomes more of a torture, which, of course, I think was the nature of that relationship. And then there's the interaction with Sasha. And yet, what is your opinion? Do you think Ingemar saw her as a female or as one of the boys? Or do you think it evolved?
I think it did evolve. Like, when he's first telling her how to hide her breasts, he doesn't seem to sexualize her in any way. He just sees her as a comrade. And later on, there's a scene where, after they were boxing, he's helping unwrap the bandage around her, and there's a shot of her back, and it seems like he is considering her femininity more. Yes.
Yeah, I noticed his looks, a lot of the same nervous looks that he had during the Barrett scenes, during the posing, I noticed that he had during the rapping scene. So I wondered if that was just the actor's too young to really probably be cognizant of it, but the Hallstrom directing him to be insecure but appear curious and show that he's aware. I think, of course, the just a warning for anybody who hasn't seen it, there is child nudity. It does bother some people, but she does show him what she has. And at first, it's the question is whether they're too big to pass as a boy and play soccer and box. But it evolves from there, too. So I guess the question for you, was that bothersome to you? Was the sexuality, the childhood nudity, did that bother you at all?
For me, it didn't, because I don't think it's in any way pornographic. Like, it's handled in such a respectful and delicate manner by the filmmaker. It seems very sort of true to what childhood can be really like, and I think it's very sensitive, actually. And just on top of that, the fact that, like, a lot of his sort of sexual incidents kind of go badly for him, it kind of gives it this extra humor, which I think sort of buffers a lot of it.
Yes, yeah, speaking of the Barrett scene, sometimes comically badly, but yes, I made the mistake of going to the IMDb forums after watching this, and you
Oh
know,
no.
I would not recommend that, but I couldn't help it on this one because, you know, of course, when you're looking at the threads and you see, or looking at the actors and you see a thread at the bottom there, but I found there's one thread that is, I think it was about in the high teens or 20 pages long of all about the sexuality, and basically some people were terribly offended about the childhood nudity and just the depiction of sexuality in a children's, well, it's not a children's film, but with children. And then the other counter arguments were people thinking, well, what that says a lot about America, that you even care, that we're even having this discussion. But yeah, I was not bothered by it. I know some people that were. In fact, my wife did not like those scenes too much. But
I mean, I think it is sort of more of an American thing to kind of not draw a distinction between nudity and sex and sexuality. And I think those can be pretty distinct elements. And I think, like, I could see maybe why people would be uncomfortable with a film that has such young children being sexual, and but I don't know, like I don't think it's meant to titillate or anything. I think it's very sort of tame, and you know, there's a inherent sort of respect and gentleness that Lasse Hallström has when approaching the subject matter.
Yeah, I think you're right. When I think of childhood nudity, in fact, we were mentioning Kinski before, and Wrong Move. If memory serves, I think she was nude in that, and she was underage. Of course, Kinski would be nude in a lot of things. and then there's, I remember, well, there's Louis Malle's Black Moon has child nudity. There's Melanie Griffith in Night Moves was nude, and I think she was underage at that time. So there is, and what's funny is she was mad about her daughter being underage in the, what was the film that came out last year based on the book? Oh yeah, it was 50 Shades of Grey was the movie. I haven't read it. Sorry for anybody that has, but yeah, there was a very awkward Oscar speech between her. But anyway, these were older actors. I mean, they were still underage by U.S. standards, but they were, you know, they were, I think, in their teens. This actress, I don't know how old she was. I'm guessing maybe 10 to 12. But yeah, I saw it more like I would see a child, you know, a baby bathing. You know, it was not titillating. One thing, I would not encourage people to read IMDb, but some people were saying that people might find that titillating, and that's what's disturbing, is that...
I mean, I think if you find something in this movie titillating having to do with the children, it's your problem, not the film's.
I agree, too. Excuse me. And so now that I mentioned that Mark was not here, but Mark did have some thoughts on the sexuality, so I'm going to go ahead and play a clip of Mark talking about it now and whether he was bothered by it.
I felt the film was respectful to sexuality and accurate. From one somewhat innocent and leering comment from the glassworkers to Barrett, to the bodily curiosity of each of the kids, to Ingmar's stronger interest in the older Barrett than his peer Saga, everyone else is feeding Ingmar sex, from his uncle to his brother to the elderly Arvidsson, who asks Ingmar to read the lingerie catalog to him, even Saga and Britt. But he is a good boy. He has perspective. But I wonder where he got this perspective.
Okay, so Mark pretty much had the same thoughts as we did. So yeah, but again, people are offended by it. So anyway, to go backwards, My Life as a Dog. One of the anchors of the movie is the character, or the, I wouldn't say the character, but the figure of Leica, the space dog, and Ingmar has these moments where he, I guess, ruminates on Leica and how uncomfortable it was and how cruel, but yet she endured for mankind. So what do you think of Leica? What is Leica's significance in this film?
Well, I think Lasse Hallström he himself describes it as a coping mechanism, which I think it's his way of dealing with being far away, feeling alone, feeling hurt, because, you know, him being sent away from his by his mother, it you know, feels a little bit like a dog being sent into outer space. And I think too, like, also you could maybe draw a connection between for instance Laika and his father being far away doing something that's for the betterment of the family, being like you know, the dog being sent into space for the betterment of mankind.
Yeah, right. And his dad was on the other side of the world collecting bananas, and when somebody questioned that, he said, well, if he wasn't there, who would collect the bananas? So I think Ingmar did have that. I think that you're right. I think that Laika was a way of explaining why he was away. And that wasn't the only rumination he had. He also thought about these horrific events. I think there was a train crash I think he talked about once, and there was one where somebody gets a javelin through the chest. Not exactly pleasant. And I don't know if, where to look them up, but I'm guessing that these were all true stories.
And a lot of them are kind of funny in a dark sort of way.
Very much so, yes.
I think my favorite was somebody trying to swing like Tarzan and being electrocuted.
Right, right. That was great, yeah. And what's weird is he does tell these stories, and then he remembers the great memory with his mother that on the beach that they show a few times. But he doesn't actually show much emotion throughout the majority of the film about being separated. He seems to be a little naive about his mother's condition and how grave it is. So I think that's another way of coping, like saying terrible things have happened to other people, but they're for the good of humanity, and it could be worse for me. You
know. And there's also that parallel drawn between his mother and his pet dog,
Sikan,
and how Sikan is not with him, and he keeps asking about his dog and how she is and if she can come. And I think partly he's doing that so he doesn't have to ask about his mother. It's also sort of a coping mechanism too. And I guess I can't spoil what happens, but I think there's another parallel between the dog and the mother.
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, yeah. And in fact, when there's an emotional scene of any sort, he tends to devolve into that barking, the one in the clip I played earlier. And and I think he's embodying Sicken, probably not Lake, maybe Lake of too. But no, I think he does. There is one scene towards the end where he does finally break down, but you're not sure. It's ambiguous whether it's about the dog, whether it's about the mother.
Yes.
So, and they don't explain it. They don't. You know, we see things from his perspective, but we do not see inside his head. It's just for us to interpret. So it is a moving film. I think most people would agree. Would you say that it is manipulative or sentimental? Or how do you think it handled sentiment?
I don't think it's manipulative. I think that there's an emotional authenticity which really helps these sentiments feel grounded. And you know, there's a lot of films out there with quirky characters and sort of a melancholy story, but they don't feel anchored in quite this way. I think that's what makes this one of the better coming of age stories.
Yeah, I think actually in the supplements, which we'll talk about, Hallstrom said that when talking about sentimentality, he said it's okay as long as it's honest. And I think in this movie, I think he did, the sentiment was honest. As far as being a manipulative, I mean, movies do manipulate you. That's just the nature, you know. And when you listen to the score, which you've heard on this show already, it is setting a mood. And so, yeah, I would say it's, but no more manipulative than say Crash or something. I mean, not nearly.
It's interesting too that he said he at first didn't want the film to have a soundtrack.
Yeah.
At all. I actually like the soundtrack quite a bit, and I think it doesn't feel It doesn't feel totally manipulative in the way that some other soundtracks do, maybe in the way that even some other Leslie Hallström film soundtracks do, but
yeah.
I think in this particular instance, you can see that he was being very, very careful not to kind of go for the easy emotion. I think he was trying to dig for something deeper in the audience.
Yeah, he could have extracted the tears from everybody. I think it could have been a much tougher movie to watch. I commend him for doing that. And speaking of the score, I think when we exit this segment, I'll play one of the more upbeat part of the score, Ingmar's theme, which is more fun, where, of course, the general score is pretty somber. Mm-hmm. So, Martin, what if you were to rate the film, we go on a scale of 1 to 10 here, what would you give the film?
Oh, I'm always bad at rating films, but this isn't one of my personal favorites, but I could totally see how it would be somebody else's. I think if somebody said this was their favorite film, I wouldn't bat an eyelid. I totally think this film is great. I guess what's a good rating system? I like it. sorry.
Tell you what, why don't you think on it and I'll come back to you, and I'm going to go ahead and Mark gave his rating and he recorded it, so I'm going to go ahead and play that and I'll give mine and you can think about that. So here's Mark rating the film.
For an overall film rating for Life as a Dog, I'd give it a 7.8 out of 10 on this second viewing. I'd say it was an 8.1 the first time I saw it. I was really taken by it. But this time, just not quite as affecting for me. So 7.8 film rating.
And yeah, I actually kind of agree with Mark in that it is a well-done coming-of-age movie. And I would say that it was also my second viewing. And my first viewing, I liked it a lot more. And I still like it a great deal. But I would say this viewing, it lessened a little bit for me. So my first time, Mark said 7.8. Mark likes these specific numbers. Mine would probably have been an 8 or an 8.5 the first time. I think I'm going to drop it down to a 7.5, even though I do enjoy the film, and I think it's an important film, not just for Hallström's career, but just for this for coming-of-age films. All right, Martin, second chance.
it's funny because it's my second time watching the film, too, and I think for me it actually rose in my estimations a little bit, because I think initially when I first watched it and dove into the Criterion disc, I had heard him say that at a certain point in the book he was going to be he was left alone in an apartment for a year, and it was actually a little bit darker, and I think my initial impression was that the story was a little bit fluffed up. Mm-hmm. But looking at it now, I think I can just accept that it's a little bit more lighthearted, and I think it can be very tricky to sort of extract those positive emotions from sort of dark situations, and I have a lot of respect for Lasse Hallström making this film.
Mm-hmm.
So I might, on a 1 to 10 rating, it might crack an 8 for me. Okay. So yeah, I do like it. Yeah,
I'd say you're right with us. So I think we're pretty much on the same board.
Yes.
So I know we all have the criterions. So what did you think? There weren't many supplements. There was really just the Hallström interview and then the short film. And I would like to talk about the short film a little bit. did you get a chance to watch it?
Yeah, there weren't a whole lot of features, but I thought they were fairly meaty. I like the short film, which is pretty long for a short film. I think it's close to an hour. It's mm-hmm. it almost feels like another feature. And the interviews are very insightful. So I like the package of it. I felt like it gave a pretty good context for both the feature film and the short film.
Yeah, and the Hallström interview was from 2002. I think it was 2002. And that's so that was after Chocolat, Cider House. So he was a big time Hollywood director. So I think it was neat to see him reflect on this movie, which really made his career. Which, and we'll talk about Hallström here in a moment. The short film, I actually really liked it. Of course, you're not going to see a lot of his early films, I think probably ever, definitely not on Criterion. But this was an exercise in improvisation, and he said it was a 1 to 2 page script, and then everything else people improvised about three different dating experiences. But I actually thought it was funny, so I didn't like it as much as My Life as a Dog, is, of course.
Right.
But I thought it was, for his first movie with actors speaking dialogue, I thought it was actually pretty well done, and a lot of fun. So what did you think of it?
Yeah, I really like the sense of humor. You can see how it's a good lead into My Life as a Dog. You can kind of see the beginnings of that sensitivity and gentleness that I think is consistent throughout his whole career. He mentioned that he was really inspired by Milos Forman's films and John Cassavetes.
He did, yeah.
And I think you can see that in his early films, especially a lot of influence that sort of observational sense of humor, that that sense for the dramatic storytelling that doesn't necessarily require a lot of plot.
Right. I mean, more Fireman's Ball in the early film than I do in the in My Life as a Dog, but I think even
in Fireman's Ball, like My Life as a Dog, sometimes when he just cuts away to an extra, the expression on their face, like that feels very kind of Fireman's Ball to me.
The point.
Way it kind of edits, especially the short film, it also kind of reminded me of I don't know if it's just the Northern European thing, but it made me think a little bit of Paul Verhoeven's early films, like A Turkish Delight has this kind of free sexuality and sense of humor and sense of also maybe a little bit cruelty or drama.
I haven't seen it, so that's two for two in recommendations on podcasts. So, in fact, I think I looked for that, and I think I couldn't find it. I don't know if it's not very well available in the States.
Yeah, his Dutch films can be hard to get a hold of.
Yeah,
but I really like the what was included with My Life as a Dog, and I like the film. So this is in a proud position on my shelf.
Well, we also give Criterion ratings based on the entire package, and I have another clip from Mark that I'll go ahead and play now. So, Mark, here you go.
For the overall rating for the Criterion package of this Blu-ray of Life as a Dog, to refer to the theme from the film, it could be worse. The picture does have mild print damage at times and seems overly grainy for some scenes. It's a bit soft at times, too. But it's also pretty natural looking, I would say. The extras are thin, though the interview with Hellstrom is insightful, and having an early film by a director that may not be found anywhere else is one of my favorite types of supplements. It does include a booklet with a short essay by Michael Atkinson called Child's Eye View, and one from Kurt Vonnegut on his love for the film. Overall, I'd give the Criterion release a 7, whose score is affected by the lack of supplements and what I thought was a transfer that may use the same transfer as the original 2003 DVD release.
And yeah, I agree with Mark that the video quality, I think, was not... I don't think they used a new restoration for it. I think if it were to come out now, they would have probably done a 2K or 4K scan. So yeah, there were some grainy moments, and it really didn't spark like you see a lot of those films. And I agree that the features, even though I did like the short film, for a Criterion release, they were pretty light. So I would say maybe a 7 for my Criterion rating. So it sounds like you appreciated the features, even though there weren't many of them, a little more than us. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, that might be accurate. I mean, I thought... I think in some ways we've been spoiled by just how lavish some Criterions can be. But yeah, like as far as the lighter sort of releases go, I thought this was pretty well put together. Did you get a chance to read the booklet?
I did not, no. In fact, that's one thing. I tend not to read the booklets until after, because I don't want to... it's not a spoiler thing, but I just don't want to steal somebody else's analysis. I want to come up with my own thoughts. So,
right.
But I do like booklets, so I usually read them after I just finished watching The Ice Storm, and that's one that is packed full of, there's an interview, there's a commentary, there's deleted scenes, there's a making of, you can see how they made the ice. So yeah,
that's a great commentary. Oh, it I is, really like it that is, one. Yeah.
He drops an F-bomb in the first 5 minutes. But yeah, when you look at that, or when you look at something like Persona, My Life as a Dog as a release does not hold up as well. But I'd still say it's an important movie for the mid-80s, and I'd still say it's worth buying just for the movie alone. So with that, I think we're done talking about My Life as a Dog. So we're going to move on now to talk about Lassie Hallström and his career after he came to America. So right after this. We're back, and we're going to talk about Lassie Hallström. We just talked about My Life as a Dog, and that's probably going to be the only Criterion release. I could see maybe What's Eating Gilbert Grape, maybe them considering it, but most likely, and that probably some studio has the rights to that. But we're going to talk about his career after My Life as a Dog. One thing I thought was interesting on the interview was that he came in his own making ABBA videos. And I don't have anything against ABBA music, but he did mention that in his home country, they were extremely popular, but he was sort of sneered at for making those. So you could maybe say he, you know, was not one to, I wouldn't say sacrifice his credibility, but, you know, he would take a project if it would make him a little money. And I think maybe he was a little bit of an opportunist when he went to America, and I can't blame him. I mean, My Life as a Dog was a huge hit for him. So he came to America, he made What's Eating Gilbert Grape, Cider House Rules, Chocolat, The Shipping News, The Hoax, An Unfinished Life, Casanova. He made a couple Nicholas Sparks adaptations. most recently, The 100-Foot Journey, and then he also made Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. So I figured we'd talk, really go in order. I think really his first big splash in America was What's Eating Gilbert Grape, with Depp, DiCaprio, Juliette Lewis. DiCaprio got a supporting actor nomination, and I think you could safely say that this probably launched his career. So are you a fan of Gilbert Grape?
Yes, I am. I might even like this a little bit more than My Life as a Dog, actually.
I think me too, actually. Now, I should also tell our viewers or listeners that I have not seen these movies in a very long time, whereas Martin enthusiastically watched just about everything before the show. So I'm going to defer to you on a lot of as far as the memory goes. Memory is that DiCaprio was amazing, and I liked Depp, and I thought it was a somber film, sometimes painful, but also sometimes comic. I think there was a cultural statement with the mother and her obesity. So I think you watched it relatively recently. What did you think about the rewatch?
Yeah, it has sort of a similar sense of humor to My Life as a Dog. It's very sort of observant, quirky kind of humor. But I think it's actually a much sadder film. It's especially the third act. It's a very sad movie to watch, and you really feel the weight of being trapped in the small town, which is sort of a different experience than My Life as a Dog. Mm-hmm. Really amazing performances. Really amazing photography by Sven Nykvist. I think that's
right.
One of the last films he shot.
I forgot he did that. Yeah,
I just watched it in HD for the first time, and I was unbelievably amazed by how gorgeous it was. It was just sort of in awe of almost every single shot in the film, because it's very subtle photography but very beautiful. I think this is probably my favorite Lassie Hallström film.
I agree. As far as his U.S. films, no doubt. It's been a while since I've seen it, but I would say that comparing it to My Life as a Dog, it's a little, like you said, it's a little different tonally and emotionally. I would say that where My Life as a Dog is a sad film, and it does pull its punches and doesn't extract the tears, I would say Gilbert Grape, if I remember right, is a sadder film and it might make you cry. Would you say that's...
I think so. Like, I think even though this might be the one I like the most, I think you start seeing maybe the tendencies begin that would lead to some of his weaker films. Like, I mean, there's this scene where, you know, Gilbert hits his younger brother, Arnie, played by Leo DiCaprio, and there's sort of the dramatic fallout from that. And I think even though that's handled really well in Gilbert Grape, you sort of see that Hellstrom kind of gets a handle on how to get people to go for the tears mm-hmm. more easily. And I think you sort of see gradually maybe his film slipping a little bit more into sentimentality.
I think that's going to be a theme going forward, yeah. And as I checked, What's Eating Gilbert Grape, I don't see a DVD or a Blu-ray release. So it maybe is not outside the realm of possibility that Criterion could get it one day. Of course, a lot of times that's complicated, and I don't want to speculate who has the rights. But yeah, and I think that after Gilbert Grape, which was his next big success, and I think really put him on the map as an American director, yeah. From there, he got caught up with Miramax and the Weinsteins, and that can be, well, it can be, Tarantino, of course, and Kevin Smith, they both had great careers with Miramax. A number of filmmakers did. Some not so much, and actually, I would say Lassie Hallström also had a good career. Weinstein got him some Oscar nominations for Cider House Rules and Chocolat. But I personally think that I agree that that's when some of the actual style and the content did get watered down, and I don't know whether it was maybe Hallström has a passive personality and would not fight battles like say Tarantino would to keep his credibility, but I do think it definitely slipped, and so yes, Cider House Rules was an adaptation from John Irving, and I think actually it was a 700-page novel, so I think given the material, he did an okay job. And good performances. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, again, small towns. Now, this was an orphanage, so it's kind of the equivalent of a small town, and the Tobey Maguire character wanted to get out and see the world. But and also there was some sexual activity that was, I guess, a little unscrupulous. There was, I think there was some incest.
Yeah, there was incest, abortion. possibly all the things that you could do that are more controversial than child nudity. So,
yeah, probably more. In fact, you're right. Probably more controversial. Yet, this was one of his most celebrated films. I think, I know it didn't win any Oscars, I believe. I might be mistaken, but I know it was nominated for quite a few.
I think, well, did, I might have to double check, but did Kane win for supporting actor?
You know what, he might have, and I will double check. So what do you think about Kane's character? Of course, he's known for the speech, Princes of New England.
I'm sure he's known for it because he says it like five times in the movie. I think you might even see a little bit of Hallström's own personality in that character, because it's sort of this gentle, you know, slightly curmudgeon-y, but very sort of sensitive figure in the film. And I think, you know, he represents sort of a altruism that I think is probably why that performance is maybe recognized.
Yeah, you could say that Michael Caine's performance or character was similar to Gunner. And by the way, I checked, and Michael Caine did win an Oscar for it. So well done, Martin.
Okay.
but I think with the Tobey Maguire character, I think he was a mentor and sort of like Gunnar was with Ingemar, and really did care for his well-being. Of course, this was more professionally because he wanted Maguire's character to be an abortionist,
which
is definitely not the tone of My Life as a Dog. But I remember I watched it, you know. Of course, I like to watch all the Oscar movies, and I remember, you know, I think sometimes the Weinsteins, you know, and all the big buzz that would come up in the late 90s and mid 90s, I think sometimes that would work against it, and I did like the Cider House Rules, but I didn't love it. I thought it was disjointed, but you saw it recently, so what did you think?
Yes. No, I feel the same way. I think a lot of elements feel kind of miscalibrated. You know, they might congeal under slightly different circumstances. Like, even the casting I thought was kind of bizarre. Like, Tobey Maguire is this sort of goofy presence, and he's supposed to be in this romance with Charlize Theron, and then Paul Rudd shows up in it. It's sort of a bizarre cast, and sometimes the tone's a little bit bizarre. Like, at times it feels sort of closer to a more emotionally authentic experience, but then you have the kid from Malcolm in the Middle coughing, and I wouldn't call it exactly Oscar bait, but I think this is sort of a film where you become aware of the certain award film elements, characteristics.
Oh, sure,
that kind
yeah.
of yeah I maybe it is Oscar bait because it got Oscars, but
I don't really like that term. I think a lot of time, I don't think Lassie Hallström thought of it as Oscar bait. However, I'd say that Harvey Weinstein, probably when he read the script and signed Hallström, I think he probably did think, oh, let's go for some Oscars. So I think
I think you're right.
And post-production, you know, Harvey Scissorhands. You mentioned Tobey Maguire's casting, and I just mentioned that I watched The Ice Storm recently. And what's funny is this is bookended by he was in The Ice Storm, and then afterward, Wonder Boys, I think, came out a year or two later. And those are two movies that I think he was perfectly cast, and he did a great job. But I didn't like him in this at all.
No, I think, like, Tobey Maguire, I like a lot of his performances, but I think he's also somebody you see miscast frequently. I think he works in a certain type of performance.
Spider-Man 3, that's all I'm going to say. Emo Spider-Man did not work for me.
And I'm just going to come out as a fan of The Great Gatsby with the...
Really? Okay.
Yeah, I like him in that.
Anyway, so you mixed on Cider House?
Yeah, I'm mixed. I mean, there's things I do like about it. I mostly sort of just spouted a bunch of negative things, but like, I think if you look at almost any individual element, like, it's, you know, I love the music, I love the photography, I kind of like individual dramatic scenes, and I think it just doesn't seem to congeal that well.
Yeah, I did like Kane, and I did get, he did convey that he was compassionate, and I didn't get bored by the speech. You know, I did, he did sell it that he meant, and he did care for those kids, and despite, you know, the controversial activities that were going on, and I thought it was an interesting story. I think actually that some of the problems could be from the fact that it was adapted from such a large book, but of course John Irving won an Oscar too for adapting it, so maybe we're wrong and Academy is right. Well, his next big film, Chocolat, I would describe it as Footloose but with chocolate.
That's the perfect way to describe it.
I don't like to use those movie mishmashes, but it just seems like it fits here. So are you a fan of Chocolat?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Chocolat. I actually like this one quite a bit. I'm a big Juliette Binoche fan. I think Johnny Depp, Judi Dench, it's got a really great supporting cast. I think of all the Lasse Hallström films that I've seen, this one has my favorite score. I love Rachel Portman's soundtrack for it.
Yeah, also Alfred Molina, I thought was good in it.
Oh yeah, for sure.
I have kind of an interesting history with this movie. When I first watched it, I hated it, and I don't know what it was. I do think it's made with a an excuse the pun, sort of a saccharine, sweet style. And a little bit artificial, I think, you know, compared to, say, Grape and My Life as a Dog, you couldn't really picture this world. It was completely, it was a make-believe French town. Yeah, so it didn't quite work with me, and I might not have even finished it the first time. And that, again, might have been one of those where, okay, it got all this praise, it was nominated for a number of Oscars. I'm sure that one didn't win. And I usually like foreign films. I love Binoche. I love the cast. Then I took a film studies class about religion films, and it was used as a way, and I think you could see how that would make sense. It was used as a way to convey atheism, sort of like secularism versus providentialism, and the conflict, you know, kind of abstinence versus indulgence. And so I came to appreciate it a little more, because of that. I think the conflict between Benosha's character and Melina's character really cuts to that. But still, it's a little too light for me, so I would say I like it more than Cider House Rules, but yeah, not as much as you. Sorry, Martin.
I think it does feel a little bit lightweight compared to, well, I guess especially My Life as a Dog or What's Eating Gilbert Grape, but I think it does feel, of a whole, it feels sort of like there's this internal integrity to it, which I really like. It's a great date movie. I think like actually probably most of Hallström's later films sort of fall into that date movie kind of territory.
Oh yes. But,
Nick, you know, I think as far as like sweet inoffensive movies about bucking the system and you know, picking on Catholicism, mm-hmm. that this is a pretty good one.
Yeah, so no,
it's a very it's a very enjoyable movie. Yeah,
I think it would have been, I could have liked it a lot more because I like the premise and I like the some of the acting. I think that maybe it was the Weinstein factor and that it did get overproduced. And I think if it were in the style of a Gilbert Grape and My Life as a Dog, a little understated, I might like mm-hmm. it a little more. But yeah.
It does feel a little like post-Amelie kind of a film.
Yeah, that's great, yeah. I very much see that. Although yeah. I think technically it was pre-Amelie, because...
Oh,
yeah. I think it was right before that. But, of course, it was Jeannot was on the map, City of Lost Children. And there was sort of this clean foreign movement going on in around the early aughts and the mm-hmm. late 90s. So, and then Hallström made two Nicholas Sparks movies. So he made The Shipping News, and I think that was his last Weinstein collaboration. Is that right? Or do you know?
Possibly. I think Shipping News didn't do very well commercially or critically.
No.
So, like, that might have been why they went their separate ways, Weinstein's and Hallström. Shipping News, like, there are things I like about it. I like the photography. Oliver Stapleton, who shot My Beautiful Landette.
Which I just saw again. It's convenient.
great photography. A lot of actors are really liking it. I think maybe my big problem with it is the story. It seems like sort of a... I don't know. It's from a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, so maybe I don't know what I'm talking about, but I think it's kind of a bad story.
Well, you know, what's funny is the novel, it's an Annie Proulx novel, and you know, my wife is an English professor, so I knew of the novel before I saw the movie. In fact, I remember when it came out, we were kind of excited about it, but and disappointed. So I think maybe
something got lost in translation. With
right, those. Maybe the John Irving worked a little bit, but Annie Proulx, I think if I remember, she might not be the easiest to work with. So maybe that had to do with it.
It could be. Like I think she wrote *Brokeback Mountain*.
She did.
Right?
Yes. Oh no. That was because he won an Oscar. I'll look it up, but that was I'm sorry, it was her and McMurtry.
It
was based on, yeah, McMurtry wrote the screenplay and it was her story, so yeah, we're both right.
Okay. Yay.
I do like McMurtry. I've studied him in college, and I think he's a good author. I haven't read any Prohl. But I think this one was intended to be an Oscar movie. I think it probably had the Weinstein machine mm-hmm. in the works, but just wasn't a good enough movie. It did get nominated for some Golden Globes, so let's see, Kevin Spacey and The Score. So yeah, and then he's made, I remember The Hoax being okay. Have you seen that? That's the Richard Gere Howard Hughes interview fake movie.
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, it wasn't great. I remember it was critically applaud, probably of his late work, probably the most critically applauded, about a reporter who fakes that he has a Howard Hughes interview because Howard Hughes was so reclusive and would never call him out on it. It was okay. And then he's done two...
The other one he did with Richard Gere, Hachi, A Dog's Tale. I know that one has a lot of defenders, but I really didn't like that one
either. I haven't seen that one, so I can't speak. But
I think like the things that we're complimenting My Life as a Dog on about not being manipulative and being grounded, I think Hachi had none of that. It's sort of the other end of the spectrum where you feel really manipulated.
I think Hallström, with his body of work after two really great movies, I think he became known as a director that you could rely on for sentimentalism, and so that segues well into his two Nicholas Sparks adaptations, Dear John and Safe Haven, and I have seen neither. I don't plan to, but
I haven't seen either one. I mean, they could be great for all I know. I haven't watched them, but I think I'm really not the target demographic for those movies.
Yeah, me neither. I gave The Notebook, which wasn't him, but it was Nicholas Sparks. I gave that an open mind because so many people did love it, and I guess I get that, but it's still right, not the target market.
No, and I think a lot of his later films, they do sort of, like, there is that kind of characteristic gentleness, which I like about his films, but you sort of also feel, like, overwhelmed with this bland inoffensiveness. It's a little bit too sweet. It's a little bit too, maybe typical of, I don't know, like, I think he eventually he starts making these sort of melodramatic fluff movies, which it's sort of too bad seeing where he started.
It is too bad, yeah. I think it's almost a director's cautionary tale. You know, if you go too far down this light line, you'll get washed up. And I mean, he's working, so I can't begrudge him. I'm sure he has a very nice house.
I'm sure as far as making popular entertainment, you know, he's making very well-crafted films. I think, like, I just watched 100-Foot Journey, and it's again within the sort of date movie territory, but as far as those movies go, like, it's very competent, it's good performances. It's just I think, like, in terms of coming at this from a angle of Criterion movie artistic sort of judgment, you know, he kind of flies off the radar.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, how was 100-Foot Journey? Looked kind of like a Marigold Hotel kind of movie. Is would you say that's
it's kind of like Chocolat Light?
Okay. Wow.
It's like the things I like about Chocolat, only less of them. Okay. So.
Now, for what it's worth, I have heard really good things about salmon fishing in the Yemen from people I respect, but I haven't had a chance to see it. And I would say that Hallström, I think he definitely knows the industry. He knows how to be behind a camera, so I wouldn't write him off. I think maybe he could surprise us and have a stellar movie like his earlier ones, but I think he definitely needs to shake things up and go a different route. And so yeah, if you were to, let's say there's an auteur meter, and say 1 to 10, we'll say 0 is Paul S.W. Anderson. Excuse me if you're a fan, but I'm not.
Or is it from Paul W. Sanderson to Paul Thomas Anderson?
Oh, actually, that's good. I was thinking Bergman, but yeah, or Antonioni or Bergman or Fellini, but yeah. So
I mean, you might want to cut this out, but I'm a Paul W. Sanderson apologist, but
I'm not going to cut it out. Right. We'll go Uwe Boll. We could.
Oh no, his movies are terrible.
Okay, well, we could call him an auteur though.
Paul W. Sanderson or Hallström?
Well, I guess both, but where on a scale of 10, where would you rate Hallström as an auteur?
On a scale of 1 to 10? As an auteur, as a looking at his body of work as a whole, like I think there's two really strong films in there, but it's not enough to balance out just a lot of kind of bland films, or films that at least don't really speak to me on any kind of deeper level. So I think, I don't know, maybe a 4. That sounds really mean, but like I think he's good at doing what he does. But
I think 4 is fair. You know, I would not, you know, some of these movies, if they're on cable late at night and you can't sleep, I would say that, like, maybe then, you know, they're all well constructed. There's, you know, but yeah, yeah. They're kind of middling. I mean, and
a bunch of these I hadn't even realized he directed, because they're not the kinds of films I would even consider who directed this.
He's almost
you know, so I feel a little bit bad saying that, but I just he's so almost turned into like you know, a journeyman type of filmmaker when he started off as more of an auteur, I guess.
100-foot journeyman filmmaker. Sorry. Couldn't help it.
I love it.
Yeah, and yeah. Since this podcast is for Criterion fans, I'm willing to bet that probably his last 10, 15 movies would not be up their alley. But I'd say definitely check out the first two. And again, I'm actually going to research it after we finish up here. But I'm curious, What's Eating Gilbert Grape might be on my wish list for Criterion. That might be neat.
Put together a pretty nice release for that. I mean, Sven Nykvist, that's definitely, Criterion loves him. And
definitely, yeah.
Yeah, that'd be great to get some Leo DiCaprio in the collection.
Yeah, actually it would. I'm not a huge Leo fan, but he did sway me a little bit with Wolf of Wall Street. I thought he was really good in
right.
that. Don't talk.
Again,
you hate it?
Great Gatsby, I love it.
Yeah, you're right. And a lot of times...
He's very good at playing spoiled rich men.
Maybe, yeah. Sometimes the shoe fits. Like we said with Tobey Maguire, you know, he's good when he's sort of a distant, emotionally void, absent-minded character. So, yeah, everybody has their type. So maybe that's the way Tobey Maguire is in real life. All right, Martin. Well, it's been great having you, and I really appreciate you pinch hitting. And Mark,
for sure, anytime.
We missed you, Mark, and we'll have you on next week. Again, next week is Geek Fest, so Mark and I are going to really geek out. So, Martin, where can people find you? Online, Twitter?
My Twitter is at Movie Kessler. People can seek me out there, I guess.
And that's Kessler, right?
Yes.
And, of course, FlixWise, I highly recommend it. You're on a couple.
Yeah, I can't recommend it highly enough. I mean, I'm involved with it, but I'm also a huge fan. I listen to every episode, and I think anyone who loves films, classic films, anyone who's watched Criterion films would definitely get a lot out of it. I think it's fantastic.
Yeah, there's a lot of overlap, too. And also, we've talked about it. I think I'm going to be on an episode... and actually maybe two episodes coming up in the near future. So I really like what Lady P is doing, and can't wait to hear myself, and hopefully it's not terrible, and you, and also what she has around the corner. Of course, Sight and Sound is kind of up my alley. All right, well, that was episode 2 of Criterion Close Up. If you have any comments, feel free to leave them on the blog, on Twitter, on Facebook, and thanks for listening.
That's it. Till tomorrow. Good night, you princes of Maine, you kings of New England.